We're coming up on 4 o'clock here in the Roaring Fork Valley. This is KDNK, Carbondale Community Access Radio. Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. Stay tuned for Express Yourself, coming up.
Here is your crown and your seal and rings. Here is your love for all things.
Here is your cart, your cardboard and piss. And here is your love for all this. May everyone live. Everyone die. Hello, my love, and my love goodbye.
Here it is. Here it is. Here is your wine and your drunken ball. And here is your love for it all.
Your sickness, your bed and your pain. Here is your love for the woman, the man. May everyone live. May everyone die. Hello, my love, and my love goodbye.
The night has begun, and here is your death in the heart of your sun.
And here is the dawn till death do us part, and here is your death in your daughter's heart. May everyone live. Everyone die. Hello, my love, and my love goodbye.
And may everyone live. May everyone die.
Hello, my love, and my love goodbye.
All built upon.
Here is your cross, your nails and your heel. And here is the love that lists where it will. May everyone live and may everyone die. Hello, my love and my love goodbye. And may everyone live. May everyone die. Hello, my love. And my love goodbye.
Here it is, and here we are, Leonard Cohen. What a great song by Leonard Cohen, one of many. I came across a really fine profile of Leonard Cohen in mid-October in the New Yorker magazine by David Remnick called Leonard Cohen Makes It Darker. Bob Dylan doesn't often play music critic, but in Remnick's article, Bob Dylan describes Leonard Cohen's expertise in the craft of songwriting, and it is worth reading. Really, really great stuff. And I just discovered today that it is available online. You can go to newyorker.com/magazine/2016/10/17/LeonardCohenMakesItDarker. Hi, everyone. Here we are again, 63 revolutions later, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler, and I'm back. And I want to thank Amy Haddon Marsh and others who picked up the slack for me while I was gone. And my goodness, you go away and look what happens. The Cubs win the World Series and Donald Trump wins the election. I thought pigs didn't fly. Sarah Pletz has a multi-decade career as a dancer, a painter, and a playwright in Aspen, New York, and Europe. Sarah has an open house this afternoon. In fact, it's just about ready to start. And I caught up with Sarah yesterday to find out more. All right, let's just wing it, see what we get.
Okay.
Yeah? I'll bet that sounds like business as usual to you. You're probably pretty good at winging it.
You know, it's part of the job of being an artist. Yes, winging it. Yeah, but that means you get to join the angels and the bird tribe, so that's pretty good.
Oh, you know what?
What?
I never thought of that connection, but of course, winging it, that means... Nice. Thank you for clarifying that for me, Sarah Pletz.
Oh, you're welcome, Luke.
Sarah Pletz joins me now. She is the power behind... the Living Arts Foundation.
Thank you.
Some of our listeners might not know what the Living Arts Foundation is. Tell me.
It's a nonprofit. Been in the Roaring Fork Valley almost 30 years. We also do business as the Sarah Pletz Dance Theater, depending upon the project we're working on. Filed both with the IRS. And we do environmental and cross-cultural multimedia.
So tonight, you have an opening.
I do.
Tell me about the opening. What are people going to see?
Oh, it's at the studio at 410 North Mill in Aspen, just by the stop sign where you turn to go to the Aspen Post Office. In the back of the building, the co-op that I started with my mom 30-some years ago. It's a retrospective of my visual art, actually. From the earliest painting is a tribute to Van Gogh I did in 1970. And the most current one is a wild, beautiful, dancing woman birthing the earth that I did last week.
And which is called Following Nature's Lead, Humans Make the Divine Sublime.
Yeah, well, actually, that's the large work I did this spring.
Oh, okay. Tell me about that.
It's 70 square feet. As we were just saying, I consider it my night watch. Rembrandt painted an extraordinary work that's in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam that is about the people in the community that were protecting. They were having a lot of trouble at night, the people in Amsterdam protecting the people who live there. And I'm very, very adamant about man's relationship to the environment. I worked with John Denver and the Cousteau family and Buckminster Fuller and many, many people over the years in the Roaring Fork. And I... know that man has the ability to live in sync with this beautiful, magnificent planet. And that's what my painting's about.
So we have the ability, but maybe not the inclination?
You know, I don't understand that. I started in high school mailing a Christmas card that asked people not to cut trees down when I was 16. I don't know. I just know it's our home, our nest, and that it's so magnificent. In the center of my painting, what I did was, a friend in Italy said, Sarah, you need to paint your parents. I was complaining about my military family. And I came back to Colorado. I work in Europe every year. And I had a chance, 6 weeks in a house with a huge wall and a kitchen and no one else there, and paper I had bought in New York years ago, large paper. It's 70 square feet, and I just decided I had to be positive again somehow. So I searched through ancient art and texts and drawings, cave drawings, paintings, to find an archetype of a male and a female that's the good stream of humanity, that those of us that know... And you know people here in Carbondale, here in the valley, that have loved and cherished and taken care of the wilderness for our entire lives here. So I painted them, and then so that my hero does not run a bank. He is pointing at the center. In the center of the 70-square-foot painting is a giant pink rose in a gold gilt frame. And in the center of the rose, there's a bee. And the bee is not even taking nectar. The bee is bowing to the rose. And the man is pointing to the bee on the rose. Now, there's also a young child, a male and female child, and you have to come see it to see what's happening to our children. Hmm. I'm trying to have a sense of humor about it, but also be realistic.
You know what? Sense of humor these days is pretty important, isn't it?
I don't know what you mean, Luke. Oh my gosh. This week in the place called the United States, I am actually a large part Native American and Penobscot. And we have been here for a long time before our government settled itself in that swamp over there on the East Coast. They do influence us all, but, you know, humans were walking on this land a very long time ago.
And is that partly the impetus behind your painting?
Yes, the woman is Native American. Uh-huh. She's mixed, but she just kind of came out that way. But the man is Greek, actually. He comes from the time of the Greeks.
Okay.
But he also looks like the English actor Julian Sand. Just kind of came out that way. But he's wearing a conductor's hat.
A conductor's hat? You mean a train conductor?
Sort of. You know, you're working at 2 in the morning or whatever, and you got to get it finished. And you're like, well, let's see. Should he have a cap? Oh, that looks terrible. Should he have this? Oh, that looks terrible. I'll leave that part. You know, and you just keep going. And then I sort of stood back and went, oh, he looks like he's on a train. I don't know. We're conducting this experiment, aren't we?
Okay. It sounds like you're bridging continents and ideas and eras in your painting.
I'm sorry, what was the last one?
Eras, different time periods.
Yes.
Greeks, Native Americans.
Well, because we have a thread in our DNA that is very old, that is in harmony with the planet. We were star-seeded. I mean, a lot of other beings came and, you know, there's all kinds of philosophies about that and mixed with the human race, but humans are star-seeded. A man who's really into physics explained to me that all of the particles that we're made of actually come from the center of a star. So we literally are star-seeded. Can we talk about the play that goes with the exhibition?
Yes, I was about to ask you about that, because not only are you painting, but you're writing, and you've done that for decades,
I know.
Thank you. Tell me about the play, too.
I've written a play called Henry's Letters. And we just did it in New York at the Stella Adler Theater in Manhattan. Oh my gosh, I'm glad I didn't know what that was going to be like. But anyway, we did it and it was successful and beautiful. We're hoping, we've got some interest in London now. And I want to do it in the Valley too, when that time is right. Henry's Letters is about letters that Henry Matisse wrote to his lifelong agent, confidant, friend, Sarah Stein, who was Gertrude Stein's sister-in-law.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's it about?
Let's see. We know a fair amount about Gertrude Stein and Hemingway and Dalí and Picasso and that extraordinary group of people in Paris in the early 20th century. Sarah was there too. She was the older Stein brother, Michael's wife. She was married to Michael Stein, Gertrude's sister-in-law, and she had a kind of feminine energy that was very deep and soft, and she could relate to Matisse, whereas Matisse was different from the other men. Someone's in my studio helping hang paintings yesterday said, he wasn't a man's man. Well, not that he was strong and very male, but we see the work he did in his late years. It's joyful, it's playful, it's different. And it's my belief after doing all this research that he needed someone like Sarah. She helped him start his school in Paris, and the play tells about that.
And Sarah Stein brought Matisse to America, right?
Yes, she did. She set up the meeting in Paris with Steichen, Edward Steichen, who was Alfred Stieglitz's dear friend for many years. And Stieglitz, as we most of us that know art know, was showing the modern people from Europe at 291 in New York. And Matisse was on the front of the ship taking the storm and had the first, I don't know if it was European or French, one-man show at 291. And then maybe 3, 4, 5 years later, the Armory show happened in New York that had everybody going, oh, no, he painted a woman with a green line on her nose. Oh, imagine that. How horrible.
It's interesting to me that, you know, so many American artists have to go to Europe to get their acclaim and their and find their audience. But it was the opposite for Matisse. He came here, and that's...
Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
Yeah, I think that changes through periods, and it changes, you know, different people doing different things on different continents. Yeah. Matisse, I will say that Matisse's grandson said, if it wasn't for the Americans and the Germans, his grandfather would have starved to death.
Huh, interesting. So the play is about the relationship between Henri Matisse and
Sarah Stein.
Sarah Stein.
And then the second act is actually how Sarah Stein... I'm not going to give it away. Had to decide whether or not to read Henri Matisse's letters to my teacher, Franklin Faust, at Pratt. And Franklin taught at Pratt for 30 years. He's a living American treasure. He's a color genius and phenomenon. And we're doing an exhibition with the play. Some of the pieces in the work in the studio will be touring. We're doing an exhibition with the play. That's called Torch, and it's how Sarah Stein chose, imparted some of the information to Franklin, which set the tone for his life when he was 17 out in Palo Alto at Stanford. And then he taught at Pratt for 30 years and imparted that to myself, to Brian Brooks. That's the three of us doing the show called Torch, the exhibition, the art show. And he imparted that wisdom to students over 30 years in Brooklyn at Pratt Institute.
Huh. Interesting. So the painting that we talked about earlier, it's a very colorful painting.
Oh, yes.
I saw a picture of
it. Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Lots of color, lots of light.
Direct descendant of what you're talking about here, your Pratt teacher and
exactly.
Matisse before that.
Torch, passing the torch.
There we go. So tonight.
Tonight. Won't be just any night.
People are going to see the painting and I guess excerpts from the play.
I'm not performing, but there. Oh. Well, I could put on the Sarah Stein hat. Maybe we'll see. But say a few words. But there's photographs from the production in New York.
Oh, okay.
And they kind of explain the relation between Gertrude and Sarah and Matisse.
Huh. And the play received its debut, as you said, in New York, and that was earlier this year?
Yeah, in July.
So it's been a big year for you.
I've been busy.
I guess. Are you still dancing?
Of course
okay.
I am. Okay, here's the best story about the play. I was responsible for part of the money. I was exhausted. I was commuting to Staten Island, which I loved because it was July in New York. It was 9:30. We usually got out of the theater at about we're supposed to be out at 10, but we could kind of squeeze to 10:15. And my knees are 65 years old, and I skied Aspen Mountain a lot, so that's tricky in the subway.
Yeah.
And the choreographer for the duet between Henri Matisse and Sarah Stein, when they say goodbye, is from the American Ballet Theater. He teaches Isadora Duncan dance. And he said, Kenneth, Sarah, the two of us playing, why don't you, this is at 9:30 on Wednesday night before Friday opening, why don't you two skip like in Matisse's painting? Every bone in my body, Luke went, no way. But they were excited and we tried it. I mean, I thought, you know, this is Manhattan, they're jaded. I mean, I'm sorry, Manhattanites. They're not going to believe a skip. But you know what? Every night of the play, in the middle of the act, when we did the skip, the audience burst out into applause.
Huh. Nice. Nice. So did you feel like a little girl again, skipping around?
What a beautiful question. I did a little bit.
Nice.
That to be in the center of a major metropolis in the West in 2016 with what we know is going on in the world, and for the skip to elate the audience. But we all want to keep skipping, don't we?
Yes. And thank you for skipping into Katie and Kay and telling me all about it.
You're so welcome. It's such a joy to see you.
So tonight, 5:15, is that what time you said?
4 to 7 tonight.
4 to 7 tonight. And right there across Mill Street from Clark's Market.
Yeah, and tomorrow also, Saturday, 11 to 4.
Oh, great. Great. Mm-hmm. Sarah Pletz.
Oh, and it's $5 donation. Includes refreshments and a raffle.
A raffle?
Yeah, for $50 worth of groceries at Clark's.
Nice. Wow. So you'll get to skip over to Clark's and eat something. Thanks, Sarah.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Well, you heard her say it. That has already started. It's been going for 20 minutes and a few hours still to go. So go over there and say hello to Sarah. It is 4:20. This is the Express Yourself show on Katie and Kay. Stay with us. Wild Feast up next. That was Dust Bowl Revival with Never Had to Go. Dust Bowl Revival plays the Wheeler Opera House next Thursday. Wow, the 17th at 7:30. You can get tickets at AspenShowTix.com or the Wheeler box office. You can get information at WheelerOperaHouse.com or DustBowlRevival.com. They are worth seeing. Well, fine stories and fine food come together in a benefit dinner for the Wilderness Workshop next Wednesday at Justice Snow's in Aspen. The workshop's development director, Rebecca Mirsky, dropped by last Tuesday along with curator Alia Howe to tell me about it.
Yeah, I'm the development director for Wilderness Workshop and proud to represent an organization that's been in the Valley for many years working to protect public lands in and around the White River National Forest. One of the things that we've been up to, however, is doing some very exciting collaborative events in the Valley this year with different wonderful folks such as yourself, Alia.
Thank you.
And we're excited to announce our storytelling event that is a part of the Writ Large series that's going to be happening November 16th at Justice Snow's in Aspen.
That's Wednesday.
That is a Wednesday, 7 p.m. We are also almost sold out. I think we have 5 tickets left.
Oh, get on it,
folks. So the focus for the evening is stories being told by local folks, the wilderness stories. And so we've left that open. I'll let Alia comment there, but they're stories that could potentially be in Wilderness, the Cap of W, or maybe just retelling someone else's story. But we're really excited to be an honorary of the event. Proceeds from the event will support Wilderness Workshop and the work that we do. And but generally, we're excited to just be a part of a community gathering to celebrate the medium of storytelling and our work here, and to introduce ourselves to, you know, new people in the community.
And the angle on this is not just storytelling, but pairing it with fine food.
That is right.
Tell me about that.
We're so lucky. Justice Snow's is really focused on bringing in and supporting local purveyors and producers in the Valley, and committed to building these collaborative events that celebrate both food and art and our community. And so Justice Snow's is doing a 5-course locally sourced dinner. There'll be 5 storytellers and 5 courses. And that will be paired with some wine and beer. And it's quite special.
And I'm looking at the menu right now. My goodness.
Yep.
Whoa.
We're pretty
yum.
Yum, yum, yum.
Yeah, it's going to be delicious.
Very. Now, local wines too?
Not so sure. Much. I think that their focus has always been to source as locally as possible. So I don't have the exact details on the wine and the beer, but I know that that was the focus. And we will also have some of the producers in-house to talk about their work and their product. And so I think it'll be an all-around really kind of informative and fun evening.
Alia, knowing your curatorial skills, who have you brought in to tell stories?
Well, we have Alyssa Rodman, Paul Anderson, Michael Marolt, Lindsay Gurley, and David Ledingham.
Nice. I recognize some of those names.
A stellar lineup. And I have to say, in asking around each time we're going to do a writ large storytelling, asking if people want to share their stories, often people hum and ha. But when I said, well, it needs to be a wilderness story, people were just like, I've got one. It's right on the money. Uh-huh. And were so excited and present to share their stories. They're really diverse. We're with Michael Marolt in Pakistan. We're with Lindsay Gurley locally, and also with Alyssa Rodman doing the Grand Traverse, to Paul Anderson being up on Sopras and his wife being on a journey somewhere else with a mountain lion experience. These stories are exciting. And this storytelling series has really been touching the heart of our community now for 2 years. It's deeply, deeply moving.
Well, thanks to the efforts of Wilderness Workshop and many groups like yours, we have a wilderness that gives us stories.
Exactly. And it's very special for us to be able to connect our work, which is sometimes difficult for people to understand and for people to agree with sometimes, and to connect to their personal love and experience of the outdoors, and to use that as an avenue to be open to understand what we do. And so this is why an event like this is so special for us. And we're going to continue to try to hold different types of different events with different creative mediums to continue to keep the dialogue going about why we care about our public lands.
And so at the event, there will be materials available for people to discover more about Wilderness Workshop, to be able to sign up and become members, to make donations, because their work is really impactful in the Valley. I am thrilled to be a part of this fundraiser for Wilderness Workshop. And I also want to give a huge shout out to Kylie and also to the storytellers. They put in a lot of work to craft their stories so that they're as juicy and dramatically compelling as possible. And they hit the mark. I'm so excited for everyone to hear their stories.
Now, do you edit these stories? Do you give them pointers? Or is this all coming from them?
We work with three editors, and so they can write out, it's totally the storyteller's choice, but they can work with an editor three times to refine and have a dialogue about their story. And then the storytellers get to work with me around performing and getting off the page again and just letting the story really live through them and be not so much as a telling, but a reading. Living a reimagining of the story as they speak it.
Sounds like a great event.
It will be.
Yeah, we're really excited.
Rebecca, thank you for joining the program.
Thank you so much, Luke.
Alia, you too.
Thank you, Luke.
Well, you heard Rebecca mention that there were only six seats left, and as of 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon, those six seats remain unfilled. So tickets and information at wildernessworkshop.org/events. Be sure to check that out. Alia Howe has become an energizer bunny in the local arts scene. You just heard her, and you've heard her often here on Express Yourself in relation to Writ Large, the Solana Justice Snows, and the Poetry Brothel. And now we get to see her talents as a dance choreographer. Her piece, Herd, is inspired by the movements of a herd and the implications of herd mentality. The piece receives its premiere tonight at the Launchpad at 7:30, with another show tomorrow night, also at 7:30. I caught up with Alia on Tuesday to hear more about the piece and her creative process. Joining the program now is Alia Howe, the choreographer for a new piece, Rumbling Into the Launchpad, tonight, The Herd. Hi, Alia.
Hi, Luke. Thanks for having me.
We also have with us one of the dancers in that program, Megan Shapiro. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Luke.
Thanks for joining us. So, The Herd, tell me about it.
The Herd is a commission from Dance Initiative, so I really want to say thank you with all my heart for being given the support to Carte Blanche create a new piece. And last year, people may have seen Vacuum, which was a light piece interviewing people and talking about what we want to vacuum out of our lives. And we were traveling around, and I kept seeing herds of cattle everywhere, and I began watching them, how they moved. And I began thinking about herds and then looking at herds of people and how they react. And my dance piece became an exploration of herd mentality. And really, when we make decisions guided by other people's opinions, that for me is like a herd response. Or when we're all compelled to act on something that inspires us, and then what involves us stepping outside of the herd, what causes us to stampede, what invokes a riot, what makes herds of people want to leave Syria, what's the tipping point? And the whole piece has been researching herd reactions in humanity, mostly, even though it started off from an animal inspiration. And I've been exploring what the herds of humanity are doing and plucked out a few subjects, like Standing Rock has a huge momentum. It's engaged the whole world. The rape of a young girl in Delhi a few years back caused the whole world to stand up, and India is now changing, and it affects, it's not just in India, it's in the whole world. And then what other things about the herd have I been looking at? How we copy one another, how we move in momentum. Megan, what else have I looked at in this piece?
You know, I'm just thinking about the flocking and that mimicking of, you know, a leader and how we get sucked into that or not. And I think one of the things that's been really interesting inside of it is the way there are expressions choreographically that are extremely tight and very choreographed and very unison, and we are literally a herd in those moments, and then sections where there is the breakaway and there is this dissent or rejection, and then how that happens and manifests itself choreographically in the space is just really interesting.
Well, that was my question, my major question, really. I can imagine dealing with these issues in written form, in spoken form, in filmic form, but I'm having trouble seeing how that manifests in movement. How did that work? It sounds like a real process.
Because we have Megan here, I'm going to go back to Megan's section, which deals with refugees, and she is working with a mannequin. And she's welcoming the mannequin. She's curious about him, wants to welcome him into the community. And the story develops then, well, this mannequin can't stand on its own two feet. It keeps falling down. But you want it to be able to stand on its own two feet because maybe you want to get on with your own life. And then what you start doing to this mannequin, what you do to one person, begins to have ramifications and effect. Other people. So as Megan is working with the mannequin, I have other dancers responding as though what Megan is doing to the mannequin, she's actually doing to them. And so this suggests that we have a huge impact with our thoughts, with our words, with our actions in the world, not just to who you're dealing with in the present moment, but it ripples out. So that's a visual human representation of that.
I can see that. Megan, what was your experience with that mannequin?
Well, it's been a really interesting journey with the mannequin. And it's been challenging in a really, really rich, wonderful way. I love doing work that is not just challenging choreographically on my body, like physically challenging, but it's also cerebral and thought-provoking. And, you know, leaving rehearsals with this mannequin, I'm going home and I'm integrating things and I'm questioning, why was that so hard for me today? Why was this part hard and this part wasn't hard today? And it's been really fascinating. At the beginning, also, before we decided who was going to actually work with the mannequin and who was going to be the ripple effect, so to speak, I went back and forth between both roles. So having experienced both sides of it and then ending up in the role that actually is in contact with this mannequin, I think also really informed the process for me. But it's been really, really a very fantastic welcomed challenge, and it's the section is serious and heavy and in parts devastating, and it is that to be in it too. And because it's not perfectly choreographed, because it's open to some improvisational elements, there are surprises each time, and there's an emotional component to those surprises because of the content of that solo.
Wow. So you're discovering things as you're going. You're not going in with a preconceived notion of things.
There's a structure and a score which Alia has created for it, and then there is space within that. So yeah, it will be a little different each night. It will be different for those viewing it. It will be different for me.
And how much of that was improv? How much of it was prescribed choreography?
Within the score, you know, I would say the score is, you know, embodies, like, fills about half of me during it, and another half of me is in that exploration place during it.
Have the improvisational sections changed?
They're different every time.
They are.
Yeah.
Huh. So they'll be different the day of the performance
tonight, and they'll be different tomorrow. Yeah.
Interesting.
And they'll be different. They'll land differently emotionally for me too, because of that, I think, which is really makes it very raw and very fresh.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Interesting. Alia, you mentioned that she's part, Megan is part of the immigrant section. You have other sections too? Tell me about the other section.
I do. It opens with a commentary about Standing Rock. And then it speaks about whose land it is, who is trying to take the land, who's fighting for the land. And then it moves into more of a herd, a stampede. It could be buffalo, it could be people at a train station. And then we move into a section that is a solo with Emily Pfeiffer, where she is talking and feeling about being in an underground in London where there was bombing, and there is it deals with that moment of getting free and all of the elements that come up when you're caught in a disaster situation. And then, boof, we break out of that and the herd is marching along. And then it becomes into a text that I am speaking. And the dancers are undressing, and they're undressing. They're taking their layers of fear off, their layers of masks. And then we move into a section called The Herd, which is the flyer. And it's just about people moving together, reacting together, maybe unconsciously, you know, maybe from programming of where you grew up, what your parents told you should do. It's very crisp and reactive. And then we move into a Latina section, which is a story about the disappearing of the Latino culture, which I read about when I first moved here. And then after the Latinas, we move into Megan's section, the refugees, and woof, we then come to the water, the healing moment, the waves of water washing us clean, washing us towards the light.
Mm, wow. You know, maybe it's endemic to where we live and the times that we're living in, but herd mentality has a lot of negative connotations. Did you discover, Megan, as you were dancing, some positive aspects of a herd mentality?
Well, I think even just becoming awake and aware of herd mentality, bringing it into our consciousness, even if in doing so you're recognizing some negative pieces of that, just the awareness alone creates positivity, right? Because then we're starting to say, oh, I'm noticing that I've joined into this group mentality, and is this my truth? And is this the direction that I want to go? Just the awareness alone is positive. And then certainly within the piece, in the final section, the water section, there's so much hope and so much beauty in that. And it is still a part of a herd. So the piece, you know, it touches on some very, very important and deep and difficult content, but there's a strong thread of hope there too.
Nine dancers. That's a lot of dancers.
Yes, it is. It's a herd.
It's a herd, isn't it? Huh. Does that change your strategy for bringing the dance to life?
Each piece I make, Luke, has a different strategy, and it's not a planned strategy. It's working with the dancers, their skill level, their schedule level, and seeing who's here, who's coming. We had a huge influx of people in and out at the beginning. I am so grateful to Dance Initiative having me teach a company class on Sundays so people can come and regularly take class and then filter into choreographic projects. So that's where I started, was who's showing up on Sunday, and now I'm starting rehearsing. I knew I wanted to do the chair section. I knew I wanted to work with how do flocks of people move together, separate, swarm, and come back and move out. I began to explore in the creative process, because I too found that most of my connotations towards herds were stampedes or riots or destruction. And so I went to see Amma down in Santa Fe, who gathers herds of devotees to come and see her for a hug. And I was one of the thousands who was moved so carefully around and through to receive my hug and then depart. So there are sections of this work that specifically have movement that I experienced while I was queuing to get my hug from Amma. And I went to see the Dalai Lama in Boulder to see what a herd of people who come to hear the Dalai Lama are about. And that was a very different situation. There were rioters there. There were protesters. There were people who handcuffed themselves to railings and were pulled away.
Protesting the Dalai Lama?
Not protesting him, but using it as a platform to protest their political issues, their environmental issues, their veganism issues. So coming back to the piece, I just began to explore the collective body of volume of animals, of people gathering together, and how do we respond? And looking at footage of them, looking at newspaper articles, building up to what was the tipping point of the Syrians coming over. And truly, the further I went back, it seemed to be, first of all, drought created political instability, people not being able to drink, and it created a hole for someone to take parties to take great power that then became violent. And I'm really oversimplifying this to then it being impossible for the people to continue safely living there, that drove them to jump off.
Was that the impetus for bringing water as a healing element into the dance, perhaps? Or did you discover that later on in the
water
process?
I knew I wanted to be you in did. There because I knew of the refugees coming over in water to... I used to live in Greece, and I taught at the State Ballet School there for 5 years. And my friends in Greece have been talking to me about what their process has been about receiving and welcoming the refugees, to them being nervous about them, to feeding them, and constantly having to reevaluate their fear about is there enough, and just to cook. So that firsthand news from them and their process, and knowing about the waters around Greece and having sailed around there, I knew the refugees were coming over on water to answer you, but also water is very healing for me. It washes. There is a need for that at the end of the piece. It is intense. I wouldn't say it's heavy. But you'll have to tell me. Come and see it. But it's a blessing. And in this piece also, the audience will be asked to participate. Maybe I'll give them clickers. Maybe I'll give them rose petals to throw. So there will be opportunities also for the audience not just to feel that this performance is being performed at them, but will you join us?
Wow, interesting. Well, despite those negative connotations we spoke about earlier, I can think of moments of beauty in herd mentality. For instance, everybody's familiar with a flock of birds and how they turn on a dime all at once, and they sort of fold in on themselves and then erupt into a blossoming of something. Did you incorporate any of that kind of feeling?
Yes, I did. And I use that in the flocking part of it. And I have always been inspired by the murmuration of birds. It's just exquisite. Mm-hmm. And I started using those images early when I was making the piece. And then in the working of the piece, it began to move, maybe because of the political environment and the voting for a new president and the whole process of that. Maybe I moved more towards the humanity of things and less commenting on the natural world. But I hope you'll see in the work that they overlap.
Interesting. I'm interested in the rehearsal process, particularly with 9 dancers. That must get kind of chaotic at times. But, you know, I'm picturing a painter in front of his easel, the writer in front of his keyboard and the screen, the singer at the piano or the guitar in his hands. How does a choreography evolve? Do you push the sofa against the wall and dance in front of a mirror and say, oh, you know, you're thinking about this murmuration, okay? How do you translate what's in your head into dancers on a stage? That's fascinating.
Well, I dream about my dances. I see images. I solve problems in my sleep. I did know that I was going to be doing a chair section, so that needed 9 dancers, and I rehearsed those 9 dancers for that. For the trio, the Latina section of the disappearance of Latino women coming over the borders, I just worked with that trio separately. And I knew the material and the movement that I wanted them to do. And slowly, we have built up. And this is the first rendition of it. And I'm excited that once it has landed after these 2 performances, that we'll be able to take it elsewhere or perform it here again so it can go into another depth. But with Megan's part, I began working with 2 dancers, Emily Pfeiffer and Megan Londi Shapiro. And with these 2 dancers, I had one of them manipulate the mannequin and the other respond to the as though they were the mannequin. And I had them switch over roles. And after a while of seeing them and probably schedule, maybe Emily went off on holiday, Megan became the manipulator of the mannequin. And it is just beautiful what she does with that. So that was a one-on-one process. And then the other 3 dancers who work in that section, Emily Pfeiffer, Gabby, whose last name I've forgotten, who is a wonderful new dancer to the Valley, and Bailey Barnum are the other 3 dancers who respond in Refugee.
Gabriela Alvarez Espinosa.
Yes. Oh, my God. I'm so excited that Gabby has joined.
Did you audition these dancers, or did you know going in, I want this one, I want this one?
No. I will work with everybody. I will work with trained dancers and non-trained dancers. I really, really welcome this small-town experience of developing a dancing body, a dancing community, and it doesn't matter on the skill level, we can all move something. And if you're arrhythmic, then you're in an arrhythmic section of the piece where you just know that you have to go to point A and to point B and doesn't. I just love working with varying abilities, varying ages. I would like to have the whole community feeling comfortable to come to company class, to come and explore movement. And Dance Initiative is certainly incredible at offering opportunities for our community around the art form of dance.
Well, the bottom line, as far as that goes, is actually having a facility.
Yes, the launch pad is huge.
Yeah.
It's become a hub.
Yeah.
What else did I want to say? I'm also working with Kyle, and I can't pronounce his last name either, who has a company called Liquid Light. And we'll see if it will happen. We'll have tech rehearsal on Wednesday. But I'm seeing also if he will be able to project images of like buffalo over the scene, of water over the dancers, of desert when the Latinas will be there. And so I'm hoping that technically we may be able to get that up and running. And if not, those of you who are listening, you know that there's another potential component that could be here. And how lucky I am to begin to explore this work. It's very different working in a small community to having worked in big cities, being based out of New York and Philadelphia, and usually working in big metropolitan cities. You have trained dancers at your fingertips, and you put together work in a very different way. Yeah. Working in a community, a small community, we need to have an open heart and an open door to let people come in and explore. Is this a good fit within my busy schedule? Does this piece grab my heart in some way that I feel compelled to explore it? And that's how the cast for Heard developed. People came and went. People came and stayed. And I'm extraordinarily grateful for all of the dancers. And I would love to give a shout out to everybody. Bailey Barnum, Dana Gansley. How do you pronounce your middle name? Gansley Ellis. Emily Pfeiffer. Gabriella Alvarez Espinoza. Jenny Patek. Megan Londi Shapiro. Natalie Ray. And Robin Hubbard. Incredible. And then another huge thank you must go to David Starber, who is now at Standing Rock, who helped collage my soundtrack and sound bites together. That's a huge time commitment. And the community in Carbondale just comes together to support the artists. So please know, community, if you need dance for something that you're doing, that I would love to support you too.
Grassroots organic dance right here in Carbondale. Sounds great. Tonight, 7:30. Is it 7:30?
It is 7:30.
At the launch pad, and tomorrow night too.
Absolutely.
Two chances.
Please reserve your seats as they are limited. I mean, do connect with Dance Initiative or give them a call.
Alya Howe, thank you so much.
Thank you, Luke, deeply. Thank you.
And Alya wanted me to mention that this show may not be appropriate for children under 13. And the only way you can get tickets is online at danceinitiative.org. Well, that'll do it for today's show. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week. Let's go out with Gogol Bordello, shall we? Gogol Bordello plays the belly up this coming, no, not this Wednesday, a couple Wednesdays from now, the 23rd, playing the belly up. It's your chance to catch the Balkan Shaman Showman. And if you haven't seen him yet, treat yourself. That show is $60. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for the news coming up. And please remember to go out there and express yourself.